Hello, and welcome to the Global Lab, the UCL Centre for Advanced Spatial Analysis podcast about cities, global connectivity, and the impact of technology. This month, we're taking a look at the relationship between science fiction and technology, and as part of a new semi-regular strand for the programme, we'll be discussing William Gibson's short story, The Gernsback Continuum. So listen on as we explore the strange loops and feedback effects between fiction and reality.
Welcome to a new, possibly semi-regular strand of the programme in which we take a text relevant to cities and technology and see what it's got to offer us. With me today I have...
Bonnie Buyukleva, a PhD student at CASA.
Sarah Wise, a lecturer at CASA.
Duncan Hay, and I'm a researcher at CASA.
And I'm Thomas Oliver-Evans, mathematician of sorts and a Global Lab veteran, I suppose. So today's text was suggested by Duncan. So Duncan, do you want to just tell us what the text's about and maybe why you chose it?
Okay, so I've chosen a short story by William Gibson called The Gernsback Continuum. Now, William Gibson's a very interesting writer. He was at the forefront of, I guess, what was called the cyberpunk movement in the 1980s. And this story is very much a settling of accounts between his generation of writers and the glory days of science fiction in the 1930s and 40s. And in this story, it's about a photographer who's been given an assignment to photograph futuristic architecture from the 30s and 40s in the United States. And he gets so into his research project that he begins to have hallucinations, and he aspects of that future that never happened, like the 1980s that the 1940s was looking forward to, bleed over into his reality. And he has hallucinations of enormous crystal cities and flying wings and 20-lane highways on which enormous finned motor cars are driving. And I think what I find really interesting about this story is the way that it very explicitly articulates a difference in the idea of the future, in the history of science fiction speaks to a utopian future, and what Gibson talks about is maybe why that wasn't such a great idea and why those sorts of ideas of a utopian future maybe seem less plausible to us now than they did when they were originally written.
So we're really talking about a future of utopian architecture and technology, gleaming, perfect, splendid stuff. Bonnie, I don't know if you have some perspective to give on the architectural trends that may have run parallel to this.
Yeah, so when I was reading the short story, this whole idea of the flawless city and these artificial structures which are imposing but naturally imposing. So the idea of these, I think he talks about marble structures which don't age, so on and so forth, sort of the conquering of nature. This really reminds me of the metabolist movement in architecture from the 1960s. So this was quite interesting because it was basically a group of architects in Japan who are thinking about how you could have a city, an artificial city, a pre-planned, from top-down planned city, which behaves sort of in a systematic way as nature does, but all of this is synthetic. So I think it's quite interesting how different and yet similar this approach is to sort of movements we're seeing at the moment in architecture, in the sense that there's always been this ideal of creating something artificial that is actually natural, or having sort of this control over nature or shaping your built environment. And in this short story, so in the Gernsback Continuum, what the photographer is so, well, petrified by is this is this pristine ideal. So this ideal from the 60s of where actually nature has been, well, the built environment is naturally artificial. And now actually it's quite interesting because we're again revisiting these ideas of metabolistic architecture or things which sort of mimic nature, but from much more, from the exact opposite side of the coin. So instead of looking at things from a top-down approach, the trend at the moment is looking at things from the bottom-up approach. So if you have a look at, for example, some of the work which is done at the Biota Lab, at the Bartlett, or some of the other clusters, looking at sort of how you can bring back natural systems into architecture, you actually see this this strive for I guess, conquering of nature and the artificial, but from a more bottom-up approach, basically, where you're taking bits of nature and then you're bringing them into the building.
That's a really interesting point, because I think there is, I'm thinking about, like, there is no nature in the Gernsback Continuum, I don't think. And there is a moment where, I mean, you mentioned the marble. So after the war, everyone had a car, no wings for it, and the promised superhighway to drive it down, so that the sky itself darkened and the fumes ate the marble and pitted the miracle crystal. So there's this idea that there's, whilst the dream might have been there, and there, I think the, I guess the utopianism of early town planning, I'm thinking also of Le Corbusier, like some of that stuff got built, but then actually the reality of what that meant, the reality of mass car ownership, interjects into that abstract utopian space and changes it. And perhaps the way these metabolic, and you'll forgive me because I've not encountered this before, but maybe it's a way of thinking about how you can account for those metabolic processes in your design.
Yeah, so I think the idea of the metabolists in architecture, so you have people like Kenzo Tange and a couple of other guys I'll not look up right now, but the project there Tange was quite famous for was this plan for a city plan for I think it was Tokyo, which was in segments so that the city would grow bit by bit. And I think the interesting thing which I guess Gibson picks up on here is that these pre-planned cities, they look very awe-inspiring on paper, but they don't age well. And I think this is I think somehow a very important point in this story, the idea of time and how actually nothing which has been designed or what we've designed so far has stood the test of time.
To be honest, a lot of that fits in very nicely with the narrative that science fiction was exploring in that era. During the sort of early Star Trek years, as I would term them, you have this idea of a high-functioning world in which money is not necessary, in which pollution is not a major concern, in which you have achieved this kind of dream environment, and your urban settlements don't, you know, are not dealing with these kinds of problems. And then you get this sort of pushback in the 80s, where you have things like this piece of work, the Gernsback Continuum, but also you have movies like Blade Runner. Where you have this nittier, grittier, ugly, dark future which has not worked out the way we intended and expected, and that's frequently shown in the architecture itself. And that's something where, as time has gone on, we've really committed to that aesthetic. So things like, if you're looking at later TV shows like Firefly or Battlestar Galactica, you have these large, aging pieces of machinery and these worlds that are messy and dirty, and that's all coming out of the sort of Total Recall era worlds that are more reflective of the world that people are actually seeing in the 80s. You know, you've had the oil crisis, you've had the slowdown and this like loss of enthusiasm, and they really reflect that in the physical environments that they're describing in science fiction. And so I assume that that was something that people at the time were grappling with through their literature. And I found that to be an interesting trend broadly across a lot of the science fiction that I've read and consumed from that time period. Obviously, Next Generation is an interesting jump back toward, well, what if everything worked out? Which is the sort of optimist in me loves. But it's very much the exception, I would say.
Yeah.
Well, I think if you're talking about television science fiction, at some point they worked out that it was much cheaper to make societies where everything was crumbling and falling apart than ones where everything looked pristine. So I think when they worked that out, there was a trend towards that kind of science fiction. It only shows with the budget of Star Trek could afford to keep on doing the utopian pretty stuff. Something you said earlier, Bonnie, was kind of interesting to me, which you mentioned the 1960s as the era that this sort of evokes, which is interesting because that's how I feel as well. There's this phrase which is kind of wonderful but sort of not really used anymore, the space age.
Mm.
Which of course is meant to evoke the future, but now really means like the end of the 60s and the 70s. And so this idea of these big gleaming sci-fi vistas and these perfect rounded spaceships zipping around as we have in this this story, this really does feel more like it evokes the 1960s to me, when I think it's even mentioned in the story that some of the furniture designs and sort of the everyday objects you'd have around the house would start to look like these sci-fi designs. But this is probably just my ignorance, because the story itself is talking about an aesthetic that dates back to the 1930s, at least Gernsback, the sci-fi writer, was writing in the 1930s. So there's obviously a whole continuum here.
I think that's what's quite interesting. I mean, I'm looking at the various Apple products around the room and thinking that I think some of that design aesthetic like retains. I certainly think that Apple's, like, certainly the early iMacs had a lot of that 60s and 70s retro. Well, it was futuristic then, but when Apple were doing it was retro. At the same time, it had this really strange oscillation between explicitly futuristic and also harking back to 1960s, 1970s, 1980s design. And I'm seeing these chairs as well, in which is no good to our listeners whatsoever.
These are Eames chairs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So often our point of reference of what the futuristic looks like still harks backwards.
I think that's I wonder whether that's the explicit point of the story. Is there's lots of things referenced in the story which are essentially amazements and would have been incredibly futuristic. These are things that actually exist in the real contemporary 1980s of the story, not the things imagined by the main character. I mean, he takes a diet pill at one point, which sort of echoes the food pills that the sci-fi characters he sort of encounters in his dream state consume. And then just the things we have around us every day, things like escalators, your moving walkways and your airports to zip you around. As you said, the sort of furniture we're sitting on now, Apple products, mobile phones, all of this stuff is the future of the 1930s. But because it's so commonplace, you get used to it so quickly.
Mm.
Actually, it makes me think of a quote. I think it's by Gibson as well. It goes something along the lines of, the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed.
Is the future particularly dense in Casa?
I don't know, but that's an interesting way of looking at it. How dense is the future in certain areas?
Well, so it's interesting because I was doing a little bit of reading about the very basic reading about the story, and one of the things that was noted is that actually the description of the city that Gibson makes is quite similar to a later half essay, half fictional account of Singapore. And when I think of a city which actually has really gone in for the hugely impressive architecture, like the mer lions with their laser eyes and spitting fountains, and this scale of construction, I do kind of think of Singapore as almost sort of living the dream, in this sense. But it's interesting because the sort of the cost of that is you know, so it's quite densely distributed in Singapore, I would say, but that's at the cost of very strict rules about, you know, dropping gum and so forth. Very strict rules about sort of spitting and this kind of thing. So, I mean, maybe this is there are places where it's very, you know, we have sort of achieved the future, but then not everyone is sort of on board with what it takes for something to continue looking like this sort of Disneyland 1930s atomic age aesthetic. It takes so much maintenance, and are we willing to actually abide by those rules and pay for that in the way that you would need to not have the pitted marble and so on and so forth?
So I think in the story, this sort of naive vision of the future, you might say, as you talk about, where there's no thought of who maintains these amazing gleaming structures, is set against the reality of the 1980s and what the future has become, with sort of wars and nuclear power are both mentioned. But it doesn't come down clearly on one side or the other, because I think the main character of the story finds this gleaming future somewhat intimidating and unpleasant in its own way. For one thing, it's a very disturbingly Aryan looking vision of the future.
We do have Godwin. Godwin's law is invoked.
The Nazis get several mentions. Yeah. So they're blonde-haired, blue-eyed people inhabiting this, which is exactly what you see if you go back to the sort of earnest science fiction films that this also kind of calls back to. For example, Things to Come, or one that I watched the other day, actually, When Worlds Collide. Just these films, in fact, in that film, particularly interesting because some planet and some star is about to crash into the Earth and they have to escape to another planet, and they choose the best of humanity to save, and they're all blonde, blue-eyed people, which is pretty disturbing when you look at it from a modern context. And so there is this question as to whether the utopia that has been envisioned is really anything of the sort.
I would say that's explicitly, one of Gibson's points, is he says, you know, for whom is this future world intended? I mean, he specifically goes so far to his the final paragraph is him, the main character, having a conversation with, like, a very non-Aryan person about how the world could be a lot worse. So, I mean, the final paragraph, it says, hell of a world we live in. The proprietor was a thin black man with bad teeth and an obvious wig. I nodded, fishing in my jeans for change, anxious to find a park bench that I could submerge myself in hard evidence of the human near dystopia we live in. But it could be worse, huh? So I would sort of say that his suggestion is that this perfect world with sort of wafer food clips and the Aryans mansplaining to each other about the structure of the city is explicitly something Gibson is saying, this would be dire. Like, thank goodness this didn't happen.
There is this, I guess, a furrow of utopian thinking that I think Gernsback is maybe that's what the 1930s American version looked like, but how much further back does it go? And I like, what's the utopianism of Silicon Valley now? Is there a problem that Silicon Valley thinks that it can't fix?
Well, hasn't who's the Apple guy?
Steve Jobs.
Jobs, no, he's dead. Who's the Facebook guy?
Mark Zuckerberg.
Mark Zuckerberg. Hasn't Mark Zuckerberg started a foundation for medical research?
Well, quite. And we have Elon Musk, who's conquering space.
Yeah,
and
his magnetic tubes to fire people from city to city.
And obviously, one thinks these are like, this is kite flying. Like, no, like, most of this won't happen. But what's that about? And is Silicon Valley Is that our guns back now? Are we going to look back on this silly, the era of tech triumphalism and laugh? Or
You've been listening to The Global Lab. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next month.